Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, sparking the evolution of education choice. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Kate Baker Demers, Executive Director of the Children's Scholarship Fund in New Hampshire. It's a nonprofit organization that helps to administer the New Hampshire Education Tax Credit Scholarship, as well as the state's recently approved education savings accounts, known in the Granite State as Education Freedom Accounts. Kate has been a champion of education choice for decades. Through her work, she helps launch schools and promotes education freedom and opportunity to make it possible for all families to choose the best educational fit for children to reach their full potential.
Today, I'm excited to have Kate Baker Demers. Kate is the executive director of the Children's Scholarship Fund in New Hampshire. I was on an Ed Choice panel with Kate a couple months ago at the Jeb Bush Conference in Salt Lake City, Utah. I was intrigued by all the amazing things that Kate is doing here and her colleagues in New Hampshire. Kate is an amazing human being in terms of her energy level and the amount of things that she's able to do. So Kate, welcome to the Reimagine podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Doug. I'm so excited to be on with you.
So let's start with some context. What is the Children's Scholarship Fund and what does the fund do?
So in New Hampshire, we actually, Children's Scholarship Fund New Hampshire, are part of Children's Scholarship Fund National, which is a scholarship organization with 18 partner programs all across the nation. We became part of Children's Scholarship Fund in 2015, Doug. I'll give you just a short background. So our education tax credit scholarship law passed here in 2012, and at the time, I was sitting as the board chair of a charter school, watching those lotteries happen year after year. In most states, charter schools are by lottery. It was a small school, so we would have about, 30 seats available, but 100 kids would apply. And right. I kept thinking to myself, like, who's helping these other 70 kids, right? I knew there was space available in the schools around us, the Montessori school, the Waldorf school, the little private Catholic school, the Christian school. I knew those seats existed and that families would want them, but they didn't have the resources to access them. At the same time, my friend was in the New Hampshire legislature. He was a state senator. He showed me the tax credit model and said, Kate, what do you think about this? He asked me, because I'm real noisy, Doug, as you've noticed, right? I'm never real quiet up here. And I said, listen, if you can get that passed, I'll quit my job and start the scholarship fund, because I knew this was a real problem. It passed the House. It passed the Senate. Governor Lynch at the time vetoed it. And so I thought, okay, great. I'm off the hook, right? Okay, good. I slowly back into the corner. Well, no. The New Hampshire legislature overrode the governor's veto and put our education tax credit program into place. And I keep my word, Doug. And so I did quit my job. I was running a software company with my friend and, Choco Tacos and air conditioning and all the posh things you can imagine. Quit my job and started the scholarship fund. I did almost starve to death like three times startup phase until, thank goodness, I had the good sense, one of my board members, to go and see Darla at Children's Scholarship Fund National and, in essence, ask for their help in running this program in New Hampshire and help us to grow. Darla, in her good sense, said, yes, thank goodness. And I became part of Children's Scholarship Fund National at that point in 2015. And then we were able to double and triple the growth of the program with their help. So that's really the whole story.
A lot of people don't know this, but Florida has a similar history. John Kirtley started a private scholarship program in 1997. And John quickly was overwhelmed with applications, like 12,000 applications in a short amount of time. And so he read about the Children's Scholarship Fund being started. And he flew up to New York, went in and said, hey, I'm your guy in Florida, in the Tampa Bay area. And so we were Children First Florida for a period of time before the Task Credit program was passed in 2001. So anyway, we have a similar DNA. So that's kind of cool. So tell me some more about the New Hampshire K-12 population. How many kids are there in New Hampshire? I know it's a small state.
Yeah, it is. Don't chuckle at me when I tell you the data. You promise, okay?
So I promise, straight face.
And our student population is declining also right now, pretty significantly because of our aging population. We're down to about 150,000 to 160,000 kids statewide.
Okay.
And so that is kids in public school. There's about 16,000 private school students in New Hampshire, and there's about 6,500 homeschool students in New Hampshire. So the way I like to think about it, Doug, is you can make a big difference here. You can help a lot of children, even with a small program. You're making a big difference. I mean, of course, every kid matters, right? Every kid needs us. We want to step up to the plate and be able to help them. And so, you know, we help as many kids as we can for as long as we can is exactly the way I look at it. And so for every child that we help, even in this small state, I feel like we're making a huge difference in their future.
Sure. So talk to me about the EdChoice landscape. You mentioned getting the fund up and running, but what are the various choices? Obviously, you mentioned charter schools, you mentioned homeschools. What else is there in New Hampshire today?
About 30 charter schools operating and a lot of growth in that space. We have our education tax credit scholarship program, which, you know, your listeners may understand because you guys have one of these as well in Florida, but that's money we raise from donors. It goes into a pool. A donor can get a tax credit for that donation. Sometimes people wonder who gets the credit in those programs, right? Does the family get the credit, or it's the person donating the money for the scholarship that gets the credit against their taxes, which is like a deduction if you're donating to the Red Cross, similar to that. And then that money goes in a pool and families can apply. They do need to be 300% of the poverty line or below. There's a lot of discussions going on right now in New Hampshire, if that makes sense or not, right, in the legislature. And we could probably have a whole college level course on that, right? But there's a lot of discussions in New Hampshire. Do those income limits make sense? Part of the legislation is also that, you know, 40% of the kids need to be free reduced lunch income eligible. We never have a problem meeting that criteria. It's always more like 60 or 70% of our students are free reduced lunch eligible, because of course, Doug, regardless of whether you make these programs means tested or not, the families that need you are the ones that are going to do your application to get the scholarship. And so we do see a heavy concentration in New Hampshire. I'll call them like micro cities, kind of like we talk about micro schools. We have these little micro cities in New Hampshire where they're slightly economically depressed. And that's where our free and reduced lunch kids are somewhat concentrated. And so if you look at New Hampshire as a whole, you know, you'll see a lot of trees, but then you'll also see these little concentrations of underprivileged children. And that's kind of where you see our scholarship groups in those micro cities that are still, the revitalization hasn't necessarily, you know, hit us up here. I mean, there's a lot of towns that look like those suburban, more wealthy districts, right? But then there's a lot of towns that really do, where the people really do struggle. We also have been hit hard by the opioid crisis. And so we do see also a lot of grandparents coming to us with their grandchildren now in their custody, and they want a better future for them, right? They don't want them to do what their own children did. And so they're trying to choose a different path for those kids. So we see a lot of grandparents. We hear from a lot of special needs kids. Initially, a lot of bullied kids. That was really hard for me in the beginning, Doug. I wasn't ready for that. I wasn't ready to hear from these parents on the phone who had children who were physically in danger. That was a really hard one for me. That was really eye-opening. You know, I kind of came at this work from my, you know, at the time, middle-class Passat driving, you know. And so some of these, the stories of the families have been, listen, I'm so glad to be here. I see this as our role in the community to help a family who's in an emergency situation. And those bullying situations are really an emergency. So we've been running the scholarship program, tax credit scholarship program, from a decade. Of course, we started at zero, Doug, right? 10 years ago. And last year, we awarded $3.2 million to about 1,350 students. It's been quite an adventure. I mean, I know this is what I'm supposed to be doing in the world, helping kids and helping people to get involved. You know, our donors love knowing that they're donating to scholarships for kids in their own communities, that they're helping them get a great education. It's really cool with the tax credit because they can say, I want my tax to go all to education, and know that they're giving directly to families. And so I love the tax credit scholarship program, and it's incredible, just incredible work to help the families to be able to do what they need to do. So that's, of course, the second thing, right? Charter schools. And then that, then we also have our new education freedom account, which is an education savings account program, but we called it education freedom account in New Hampshire as the live free or die state. We thought it's education freedom, it to us, not necessarily savings. And so that was, we also run that education freedom account. We've had that in place since 2021. It was July of 2021 when it passed. It was August 2021 when it took effect. And we had families with education freedom accounts in November of that same year. And so that's been a true adventure. There's so much learning to do in that space. There's so much learning for the families, so much learning for the administrators, so much learning for the citizens and legislature. You know, that's a teaching job for sure.
So I'm going to do a deeper dive on the education freedom accounts, because obviously that's the wave that's sweeping across the country right now. I'm going to step back for a little bit and talk about legal challenges. Almost all of us get legal challenges on a fairly regular basis. What have been the legal challenges in New Hampshire with the various programs, and how have you guys been able to navigate those legal challenges?
So I'll just do a little shout out here to the Institute for Justice, because the Institute for Justice has helped us from the beginning. We could have, you know, you remember when I talked to you about how small we were in the beginning with our education tax credit scholarship. I mean, we were only helping maybe 50 children at the time when the teachers union and the ACLU sued the state, saying that it was unconstitutional because a family might choose a religious school. At the time, we could have never afforded any type of legal representation. I mean, I literally had like a stick and a piece of duct tape at the time trying to get the program up and running. And so the Institute for Justice did represent families in New Hampshire and us actually as the scholarship organization pro bono. So thank you to the Institute for Justice. So that went first to a lower court that actually did rule wrongly that it was unconstitutional. And we weren't allowed, frankly, they told us to discriminate against families and not give a scholarship to a child that wanted to use it at a religious school, which we know is discrimination. So the lower court said, this is a New Hampshire lower court, said we should discriminate against families. We knew that was wrong because discrimination is always wrong, right? And so we appealed that and ended up in our New Hampshire Supreme Court. Our New Hampshire Supreme Court actually like remanded the decision, said the lower court was incorrect, and threw the case out on standing, saying that, in fact, nobody could even say that there was anything wrong with this because it was private money. So the money someone donates to a scholarship is their money. Giving it to me because they take a credit or a deduction doesn't make it the state's money. And so in essence, that's what the New Hampshire Supreme Court said. And that was about 2014 when we finally were able to run the program unencumbered. The other challenges that we've had is, I think we may be the most challenged program in the nation. We've had bills every legislative cycle until from 2012-13 when we started to 2018, every legislative cycle, there was a bill to change or eliminate or reduce or some sort of discussion in the legislature about eliminating the program. And so we've had to have that discussion year after year after year, which made it so that actually, I mean, I hate to say it, but talking about the Education Freedom Account was easier because we already had been discussing school choice in New Hampshire for a decade. And so, yes, so we've won in the New Hampshire Supreme Court. We now have another lawsuit that's going on here in New Hampshire where the president of the American Federation for Teachers herself has sued the commissioner, weirdly himself, saying that she thinks the funding mechanism of the Education Freedom Account is illegal. And so they'll be having that discussion in the courts in New Hampshire. And again, the Institute for Justice is representing families in that as well, and has continued to be supportive and represent people from New Hampshire or us pro bono. So again, thanks to the Institute for Justice.
Yeah, in Florida, we also had a suit against the tax credit program. We also won on the standing issue. At the time, it was a Democratic court, interestingly enough, and the Democratic court ruled 6-1 that the plaintiffs didn't have standing. They've threatened to sue on the direct state funding aspects of our programs, similar to what you just described in New Hampshire, but they haven't done that yet. The court now is a different court. DeSantis, Governor DeSantis has appointed most of the members. So I think a suit would be a long shot, but it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds in New Hampshire. So let's talk about the implementation of education freedom accounts. We both know those are way more complex to manage because of how families can spend the money. But for our listeners, walk through a family's experience when they apply, how they get funding into an account, how they spend that money. Do you do reimbursements? So just walk us through the logistics of how you guys manage that program.
Some of the fun things is, first of all, just for a tiny bit more background. So the New Hampshire legislature, when they were passing the Education Freedom Account bill, included in it that it should be run by a scholarship organization already running the tax credit. So we are a lean, mean, fighting machine state. We don't like to create more bureaucracy. Like, they didn't want to pass a program that then made more red tape in our state, okay? So they were really thinking efficiency right out of the gate. And so what we did do initially for our parent application system, remember, we were already accepting applications for our scholarship tax credit program, and the income limits are the same on both programs, Doug. So for our tax credit scholarship program, it's 300% of the poverty line or below. For the Education Freedom Account, they said 300% of the poverty line or below. So we took our existing application scholarship database. We made it do an application for both programs at the same time. You can come to us, you apply for our tax credit scholarship program at the same time you apply for the EFA. We just had to add some EFA language into our application, but we kept it really simple and streamlined. It's one page for the parents to go down, and you can say in the application, I want to apply for one program or the other program or both. And so that's how we got that piece up and running so quickly. We survey our families. About 80% of them tell us that it's easy to apply. And so I think we did a pretty good job of making that fast, right? Because we had to move really quickly, and also getting it so families either already knew how to apply because they were applying for the tax credit and they were adding on the EFA, or they found us really quickly and were able to do the application. One other kind of interesting policy piece, Doug, is our EFA and scholarship are stackable. So you can get your Education Freedom Account, and you can also get a scholarship on top of it. I see your eyebrows raising. It's actually smaller dollars in New Hampshire than only our state funding. And so it's exciting for families. Our average Education Freedom Account is $4,600. You might still need a scholarship on top of that to afford some of our lower cost, even private high schools. So take your Catholic high school. It's probably $12,000. Or 13 to go there. So you need the Education Freedom Account and a scholarship if you're a low-income family. And the legislature made that possible. So the way we're running the program from the application process makes sense in that regard.
Yeah. So a family who wants to go to like a high school, they would need both scholarships. A family that's a homeschool family, for example, would only get the Education Freedom Accounts because you really couldn't spend the tax credit money because it's only for tuition and fees at a private school.
Yes, there's one other interesting thing about our distribution like that. So they did legislate in our tax credit scholarship that special needs kids get a higher scholarship. They also get a higher Education Freedom Account. And so because of that, some of our special needs families of special needs kids can get closer to $10,000, in which case they can really buy their services and therapy and pay your OT and speech and and that really empowers them. And so we love that piece of the program too, that if a special needs kid family needs a bunch of services, we can help them get there.
We've got about 68,000 kids who are what we call them unique abilities. And it's a whole diverse population, spina bifida, Down syndrome, autism, all the way to sort of learning disability. So that program's been really popular for those kids. But the same reason you just said, if you got a child with some of those issues, you need a lot of flexibility with your spending. So that program has been very, very popular. I'm sure you're seeing the same thing in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I can think of a family who had a child. Unfortunately, he was in an accident. He was hit by a car and he had a brain injury. He's gotten to the point now where he's recovered so well that they actually did volunteer and help at our National School Choice Week event. We had a school fair on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So they're volunteering. But he needed a lot of specialized educational services. I remember years back, the family talking to me about this special tutor that worked on his eye tracking issues to be able to regain his reading capabilities. Mm-hmm. I love helping those families and those kids. I think, you know, if we can make it so a parent or family can do exactly what their child needs to, say, recover from an accident or to make learning gains when otherwise they weren't making any, you know, showing growth. I mean, to me, that's just, oh, it's my favorite.
So you're an amazing advocate. You have a reputation around the country as being the Energizer Bunny. I mean, you have a lot of energy. So talk to me about advice you'd give to other advocates in other states that would like to replicate your success. What kind of messaging do you use to get your legislators to pass the kind of ed choice bills that you guys have been very successful in passing in New Hampshire? What advice would you give to your advocate colleagues around the country?
So I think first, it's my authenticity, Doug. I mean, these are real people, right? So, I mean, I have the opportunity to talk to the families that participate in our Children's Scholarship Fund programs every day. And so first and foremost, they are the ones that drive these programs into being. And I think I see myself as a messenger for the families in New Hampshire. In particular, I also have a background. So I don't usually talk about myself, Doug. I rarely do. But I actually was a free and reduced lunch kid from a low-income neighborhood. And so I also, in many ways, can relate. And so I think it's that piece forward where my experience as a child, in addition to my experience as a parent, and then, you know, sharing the family's stories and talking to the families about how they can share their own story, I think really makes all the difference. In addition, I operate, as you've noticed, with like extreme transparency, okay? So I always say, do what I'm going to do and say what I'm going to do and then do it, right? And so I would also offer to people that, particularly in these types of programs where we have the responsibility as stewards of both money that people are donating to us, right? Where your entire job is to do what you say you're going to do with the money that someone donated to you, make sure it gets to the families, right? And then also with the Education Freedom Account, where it's the child's public education dollars, now they have access to use it. I mean, I see that as a huge responsibility and an honor to be able to do that. And so I think operating with total transparency and also being available to answer everyone's questions year in and year out, that was piece of it. I think also my team has such a high level of expertise that we really work to do things correctly. And I know that sounds just like, of course you should do it correctly. But when you take correctly doing something and add transparency to it, then people can understand what you're doing and why. I think also being able to explain how it will work or how it does work is extremely instrumental, because when someone doesn't understand something, they're not going to say yes, right? A legislator can't say yes to something unless they actually can understand how it's going to work. And so having examples and saying, this is what it will look like when a family accesses the digital wallet. I remember talking over and over again with people who had questions about, well, what if a family wants to return an item? What if they want to buy buy monitors, computer monitors, and then they want to return them? Well, if they buy those in our platform, they can't return them without the platform. And then the money goes right back into their account, right? And so I had to explain even how all of our systems would work so that anybody could conceptualize it. And so I think those were kind of the keys.
Do you feel like politically you're over the hump in New Hampshire, that there's always going to be noise about you're hurting the district schools and there's no accountability and, you know, blah, blah, blah. You're trying to privatize, public, you know, all those things. Do you feel like you're sort of over the hump, that there'll still be the people complaining, but politically you're kind of in a situation where you're not going to go backwards.
I don't know. I think there's still a lot of missing information in that regard. So, for example, in our New Hampshire programs, both of them, our tax credit scholarship and the education freedom account, a family can use it to pay tuition at an out-of-district public school. And we have quite a few families who are using it that way. They're paying the districts for classes, courses, and tuition. And I still don't think people are seeing that. And so we do to make sure that we're getting the information out there about that and showing them, like, you can use this as an opportunity to grow your student population. Remember, student population is shrinking in New Hampshire. I think districts could create specialized programs and attract kids to it, but they're not seeing that yet. The other piece of this program the legislature did was create this mechanism where once, if a child takes an education freedom account, the district is whole in the first year, so they still get paid, and then they get paid 50% in the next year and 25% in the year after. And I think still people don't know about that either. And so they're not seeing the benefits to them yet. The other thing I noticed is the discussion is the same as for the Education Freedom Account as it's been for the tax credit program the whole time. Some people are just not going to like it, and they're just always not going to like it. And so when I go there again to discuss things with people, I'm just totally transparent. I'm like, you may or may not like this, but here's this data. And so I think that discussion will continue. I also remember living in a swing state, New Hampshire, where it's purple. And so the politics changes. You know, sometimes the Republicans will be in the House and sometimes the Democrats will have the majority in the House. And so I don't know if it'll ever, that discussion will ever stop. Which is maybe why, to your point, you're like, you're really good at it. You know, I've been talking about it all day, every day, answering people's questions. And so I think there's a lot of benefits to public schools in this program. I mean, it is public education, and there's a lot of benefits to public district schools. And so I would hope that at some point everybody will figure that out.
Well, it's interesting. We're having the same discussions in Florida. There's all kinds of opportunities for district schools, for charter schools, even private schools. I met with a group of Catholic superintendents yesterday in Florida and said, look, in the fall of 2023 in Florida, there's probably going to be over a quarter of a million kids with ESAs. So you have a huge opportunity to unbundle some of your services and reach out to those families, saving with the school districts. I think it's going to take a while for people to sort of get out of a mindset that they've been in for a long time and think about how do you really provide customized education services for families, which is really where we're going. But we're sort of that in transition. I think a lot of the supply side, particularly traditional school districts, even some charter schools and private schools, haven't yet caught up with the opportunity. I don't know if you see this in New Hampshire, but in Florida, there's an influx of new supply being created by teachers in district schools who are quitting their jobs and creating these very cool, innovative schools. You mentioned some earlier, whether it's Montessori or Sewberry or Waldorf or whatever. We're seeing a lot of that. And so I think that might be a wake-up call to eventually with the traditional educators, institutions, that they see all this innovation around them and seeing parents being, you know, gravitating to all the innovation. I'm hoping that eventually has an effect. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, we have a school just like that, Doug. A public school teacher noticed during the pandemic that the students in his classes were learning better in micro groups, in small groups. And so he did leave, quit his job, and started a micro school in Nashua. It's called the Harkness School. And he's doing both, you know, full days. You could go there full days if you choose to, but he's also unbundled all the courses. So you can go there for a class or course, or you can go there for a full day. It almost, people seem to be moving towards what looks like, you know, community college for little kids, right? I'm noticing these learning centers popping up, and I'm noticing the co-ops and the micro schools. You know, it seems like it's like you can go there for a few days and choose three courses or five courses or advising services. And I think that's really cool because, you know, if the pandemic showed anything to us, right, if it did anything positive, it was that it opened our eyes to the fact that one size doesn't fit all was never a talking point, right? But I think after the pandemic, everyone understood what I was doing finally, right? When I said I'm helping kids to be able to, you know, right, go to an alternative type school or, you know, buy curriculum and their laptop for homeschooling. Finally, everyone was like, oh, what a great idea. And so I think that it opened our eyes more, and it opened our regular community's eyes to the fact that buildings aren't the only place that education happens, right? And so if you're tying the child's education funding to buildings, you're missing a huge piece. And I think the medically fragile children during the pandemic were illustrated, you know, like that was a good illustration where we knew they still needed education services, but we also knew they couldn't go into buildings. We had to push the box out and say, how do we get these kids the services, curriculum, books, computers that they need, and when they're never going to a building again, right? And so I think that really did help everyone to understand what we've been talking about this whole time.
I talked to a group of educators over the weekend, and I said, in many ways, if you understand history, this almost looks like going back to the pre-urbanization, pre-industrialization. Now, back in those days, most of the education was for the more elite, but it wasn't until we urbanized and industrialized that you created these big factories that we called school districts and district schools, and sort of one-size-fits-all assembly line education coming out of at the end of the world of Civil War. It feels like we're going back to the future. The diversity that we had before we industrialized public education, that diversity is coming back, and the creativity and the innovation that educators had is coming back. So hopefully we'll be able to go to scale with what we're talking about, and every child will have the access to have this kind of freedom and this kind of customization that best meets their needs. So obviously you're one of the most successful people in the country in the EdChoice movement. Is there any other advice you would give folks who want to emulate your success?
Yeah, surround yourself with people who are geniuses and then ask them what to do and follow their instructions. That's my trick. Okay, I ask people who are experts. I surround myself with people who have brilliant minds and tons of experience. And then I say to them, what would you do in this scenario? Then they tell me, and then I do exactly what they say to do. I also do what I say I'm going to do every time, Doug. Right. And so I think, again, transparency and consistency and honesty are all of the things that we bring to the table. And then, you know, ensuring that we're always in service to the families. I mean, I see myself in service to my community, in service to the children of New Hampshire and the parents of New Hampshire. And I think if we can keep that mindset, then we'll be able to help them.
Well, Kate, New Hampshire is lucky to have you. The EdChoice movement in New Hampshire is lucky to have you, and nationally, we're lucky to have you. And so I wanted to say thank you and tell you how much we all honor and appreciate and respect the work you're doing there. And again, just say thank you.